Right, this session is an attempt to help us with leading overview. You should have a handout that looks like this. I'll give you another handout in a moment. Worth saying up front that skills in handling passage and writing Bible studies is not the most important component of being a gospel minister or a group leader. So if you look at 2 Timothy and Titus, as Paul gives advice about who should be in gospel leadership, there's a huge amount on character and a little bit on abilities and skills. So he does say they need to be able to teach. He does talk about being able to lead people, manage a household. So you do need some leadership skills and teaching skills, but actually godly character is far more important. Where our hearts are at is far more important than just how good we are at constructing a study. But in this particular session, we're working on skills. Before lunch, Rob will help us think about our attitudes and why we're doing what we're doing. So that is really important. That's why we're ending with it. But this session is about skills. And I think it's... So that's the kind of before... That's the box at the top. Before we get onto the skills, what kind of leader do you want to be? But I won't talk through it because we're doing stuff later. But I think this session is useful because overview is a different challenge. My reflection year by year has been, as we go through the year, I keep thinking, oh, I wish I'd given us more help at the start of the year to know how to kind of go about it, as people have asked me questions and follow-ups and things. So this is, I think, is useful to think how can we actually go about it. Let's start by asking, what do we think are the specific challenges when it comes to writing an overview study or leading an overview study? What are our worries? What do we think are the challenges? What makes it difficult? Perhaps you're all feeling very confident. There's not going to be any difficulties. Long passages, brilliant. I can see you've read the handout. Good. Long passages. So don't look at the handout or else we'll just go through my outline. Oh, strange passages, good. Oh, strange, thank you. Strang passages. Other things that make it tricky?
Passages with lots of interesting points that aren't actually the main point.
Yeah. Lots of quirky details. Quirky details. If I make up any words on this thing, I've probably just misspelt them. Good. Yep. Stress on details. There's lots of details in there. Yep, good. Other things might make it difficult.
Understanding passages in their context when we keep jumping into different...
Yes, really helpful. So, as good RMLers, we all know that context really matters. But do you have time to read the whole of the rest of Genesis before you teach Genesis 1? Yeah, good.
And there's a continuity thing. So, this is probably heretical, but with a gospel or Romans, you can to some degree miss a couple and still get a lot out of the study you do get to.
Mm.
Whereas in the overview, if you miss a few, then you can be really like one extra on.
Yeah. Miss bits and something goes really badly wrong, die. Obviously you don't die, but die question mark. You know what I mean? Yep, thanks Andy. Nice. Yep. Unfamiliar. Good.
Or even the flip side of that, in that some mystical understanding of some of the stories might not be the main point that is actually what the Bible is saying.
Yes. Yeah, so our kind of, our bag of knowledge, you know, I don't know if you had someone did that illustration that at RML you want to leave your bag of knowledge kind of at the door so that you can say what's the Bible actually saying, not what I think it's saying. But for lots of us, our bag of Old Testament Bible knowledge is pretty ropey. It might well be based on stories and songs you've been told and sung. Someone was pointing out I didn't sing the song right earlier. I'm sorry. If it was a non-standard version and offended you, I apologise. Good. Any other things?
People.
People, yes. Well done. always the hardest thing about leading Bible studies is people. If there weren't people there, you could have a great Bible study. It is genuinely, I mean, that's true in gospel ministry generally. People, as in us, our sin, and other people's sin is always what makes things difficult.
It's relating the two. Like, so I was just thinking, so if you know you've got someone in your group who's barely a Christian, or is maybe thinking about being a Christian, and you go into a study on the Nephilim or whatever, you're thinking, oh man, like, how on earth am I going to... So last year we had this guy who's like a butcher who really didn't really get much, and yet we were leading this phenomenally complex, though we didn't understand a REM 5.
Yeah.
And it might be worse this year.
Yeah, brilliant. So with people, how do I pitch it? That, I think, is a really big issue, actually. How much can this particular group of people feasibly take on board in one evening? I think it's a really important question as you try and shape your study. Easy to think we want to nail every detail in Genesis 1. This is our chance to understand Genesis 1 in all its depth and complexity. But actually, how much can this group take on board in one sitting?
I think also just kind of keeping the study going and giving the big picture. I know sometimes in our group we got bogged down by little questions.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, yeah, just trying to answer those questions and not just sort of brush them off and say, "Have that one, we'll do it later, you'll deal with it." But
yeah. So don't get lost and don't get bogged down. Yeah. Ooh. Yeah, good. Lots of difficulties. Good. I think lots of those are real challenges. And some of them are on my list, which is happy. Let's have a look at the first page. I'll flag out some of the difficulties. Oh, yes, absolutely. Anyone else? No, good. There are... Sorry, I'm just thinking on time. When do we finish? Okay. Yes, there are some ways in which overview studies are quite different to studies we may be used to leading in Mark and Romans or used to sitting in. In lots of ways, all the same things or similar things about how you lead a Bible study do apply. So actually, let's start. Sorry, the thing I was wondering about just then was whether to start on the back of the handout or the front. Let's start on the back. But we're going to fly through it really quickly. So come and ask me or ask other leaders who've been doing it a while if you want more information on this. I'm aware that some of us are new to leading, some of us have been leading for quite a while. There are all sorts of ways in which overview leading is just like any other Bible study leading, some of these things on the back. So I'll fly through them and then we'll look at how overview is different. So overview is similar in that we should keep, and each time there's a cheesy sports cliche to help you remember it. So in fact, two cliches for the first one. So first off, keep working on the text myself. And actually, I find I need to remind myself of this for overview because it's a big passage. It can be easy to just be lazy and skim through it and then just decide what I think it means rather than working carefully on the text myself or waiting till Slob tells you what the kind of St. Helens line is on this particular passage, what the overview line is on this passage. Much better to be working hard on the text and thinking what God says rather than me or Michael or whoever else. The cheesy cliches are nobody can run a marathon for you, which is partly saying we want to be, I hope, reading the Bible for the rest of our lives. And RML is a chance to be coached as we grow in it rather than not having to work on it because someone else is doing the work. Does that make sense? So I'd love us, rather than kind of during RML, I'll let someone else read the Bible for me. But then later in my life, I'll try and read it myself. But rather say, I'm going to read it myself to the best of my ability this year, knowing that I'll be sharpened up and helped by the other leaders in Slob and that kind of thing.
Can you say a word about when to do prep?
Yes. Later. Yes. Good. So, I will say that now. So well worth having your passage prep, as in understanding what the passage is actually saying before Slob, and then having after Slob only a case of how do I actually teach that to the group. So you may be used to that anyway, but so prepare what do I think God's saying from the passage before Slob, then after Slob it's just how do I teach that to the people. Rather than what can happen if you get kind of behind and rushed is help, I'll skim read the passage before Slob, then after Slob, I spent my time trying to work out what they were talking about and kind of, I didn't follow the discussion. Can I try and piece together a main point from what everyone was saying? And then how do I teach it? Much better to do the passage work, front load it before Slob. Good, so that's partly because on the long term, it will really help us if we're growing in our own Bible handling. But also, players make the best coaches. So if we are excited by the passage, if we've heard God speak for ourselves, then we'll be fresh and enthusiastic as we try and encourage others to read the Bible. And we'll have come across some of the same struggles in different genres and different passages. Good, keep crafting varied questions. So that's say, different questions are good for different things. Big questions make people think. Big open questions, lots of answers, help people talk, help people think. Then they're not really leading. But they're also quite scary. So if you open your first ever overview study with, so what's the purpose and main point of Genesis 1? That's quite scary. If you say something much easier, like what were your first impressions, or what's the best bit of creation in your opinion, that's a much easier question. You need more than one club to play golf. So I don't play much golf, but when you tee off, you're trying to go a long way, so you use a wood, but it could go anywhere, and that's the case with a big open question. But as you get closer to the target, you kind of change down clubs until you're getting smaller, more accurate questions to kind of sharpen up people's understanding so that you do end somewhere useful. So keep crafting varied questions. Keep working with where the group is at. Again, golf, I'm afraid. Sorry if you don't like golf. Hit the ball where it lies. As in, it can be easy in overview to kind of think people have to say things in my language and have to notice all the same things that I've noticed in my prep. And I want us to, and kind of keep bashing people until they say exactly what you wanted, exactly in your language. Much better to work with where people are coming from. So to be in the same ballpark, to be same talking about the same kind of ideas, but it's okay if they use their words rather than your words. So I'm trying to say God is the undisputed creator king. So that's my main point for Genesis 1. They say God's really in control. That's fine. Different words, that's fine. Someone else says he's the boss. That's fine. Someone else, yeah, get the point. Work with where they are. And with that, don't force them to come up with five bits of data, five reasons for that main point. If they've seen two or three and got the point, that's fine. You don't have to kind of slave out every last detail. Keep an eye on group dynamics. This is normal kind of how to handle a group tips. In tennis, kind of two people are playing and the ball goes back and forth. The leader asks a question. This is the leader. The keenest person in the group who's done lots of prep answers it. And then the leader comments, and then it comes another question. And it kind of goes back and forth like this between the keenie and the leader. And everyone else sits there watching, just like you watch tennis. It's kind of this experience of, okay, there's another question. What's he going to say? There's another question. And it's very easy to drop out of understanding if these people aren't involved. The ideal is squash, where the ball bounces off the walls a few times before it comes back. So the leader launches a question. I don't know, what do we see about God in Genesis 1? One person says he's really in control. Someone else says he's really good. Someone else says he's really imaginative. And that kind of bounces around a few times. You say, what do other people think, etc., 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 before eventually the leader gives some closure and say, they're all there, but I think this is the big one, or those two things were completely wacky and not there. Or ideally, you even get the group to do some of that assessing, which of those ideas is a good one, which is not, which are the biggest ideas, which are not. So keep an eye on group dynamics. We're aiming for squash, not tennis. Keep letting others speak. So that's similar to that. The group leader doesn't have to be the one who always caps off the discussion. If you can get other people to do a summary or other people to assess which is closer to the text of a couple of ideas, that's really good. And keep using your co-leader. It's a real blessing to have someone in the group who's on your side and is freed up from thinking, help, what's my next question, and all that kind of stuff. Freed up to listen and to watch. Those are the biggest things that a co-leader should be trying to do, listening really carefully and watching the group. just to see, are people following? Has anyone dropped off? Was someone about to say something and the leader didn't notice and moved on? Did someone say something that was properly wrong, but the leader didn't really notice? Because, you know, as a leader, you're sometimes just, I want to say my next question. I'm sure I didn't listen to what they said, but I'm sure it must have been okay, so let's move on. That's where the co-leader can say, oh, hang on a sec, that person said there are two gods in the universe. Do we think that's absolutely right? Or whatever it is. So there's no I in team. Keep using your co-leader. And keep working hard. So I mentioned this on Friday night. Paul had Olympic intensity in the way he did gospel ministry. He was willing to put his body through kind of a really harsh and disciplined program to help other people get to heaven. So excited was he about people being there on the final day. So do keep working hard, and I'm aware that will be in lots of different areas. Good, that was very quick. Feel free to ask me or other leaders if you want more advice on how you actually do any of those things. So I'm sure amongst the group, I'm sure there's lots of wealth of insight in things like, how do you deal with loud people? How do you deal with quiet people? How do you keep everyone talking? I'm sure there's lots of stuff we could say about that. But in some ways, that's all stuff that's common to any Bible study. My aim for our time in this session is to think more about the differences of overview and how we handle those. So let's work through the differences, and I'm pleased to say most of them we are aware are already differences. So back on the front page of the handout. Well, any questions just on the stuff I've said? Any questions? Any burning questions? Nope. Good, okay. So, overview studies are a bit different. Long passages, they are long passages. Sometimes a chapter, sometimes two chapters, sometimes five or six chapters, sometimes an entire book. When we get to Nehemiah, we read the whole thing. So they are long passages, which will affect all sorts of things. For example, it will affect, you won't always be able to read it on the night. You might choose to read a small bit of the passage, but unlike Mark or Romans, where I guess you would read the passage and then start talking about it, in overview, often you just jump in assuming everyone's read it. Which makes the first sub-point fairly obvious. Prep is essential. If people have never read the passage and you don't read it in the group because of time, it would take half of your study time, well, they're going to be completely confused and lost. Doesn't matter how good a question you ask, if they've never read the text, they're just not going to be able to answer it. Now, in some ways, that's good. It's obvious with overview that people have to prep. It's kind of, it gives us a fresh chance to say, do you see how prep will be essential to both to you making the most of the group and helping other people. But it is essential. And I think, think through all sorts of ways you can encourage people. I think prep is best encouraged both at the group level, having an assumption that it will happen, that it's necessary and it will happen, but also one-to-one, just chatting through honestly with people, how do you find prep? Because this is true in gospel ministry generally, but people have very different reasons for why they do what they do. So there are a few people who don't prep because they're lazy and don't care that much about the Bible. There are lots of other people who don't prep much or very well because their life is completely chaotic and they just can't handle life and they need help in either planning time or in saying no to something or taking something off their schedule. There are other people who make the time and they've got life sorted enough to have a prep slot, but they just don't know what to do. They get to the Bible, and especially Old Testament, this will be true with overview, they just don't know what to do. And obviously the prep manual is designed to help a bit, but even then they might not really know what they're doing, how long it should take. Maybe we say, I'll set aside an hour, but they just don't know how to fill an hour. So they end up just skim reading it a couple of times and coming to studies. So I think that's where the one-on-one chats are so important. And same with issues of godliness. Actually asking people kind of, why do you struggle to prep? Or how are you finding prep? How could we help you better with prep? Is there any way we could give you extra prep tips or extra prep questions or run the studies in a way that makes the most of your prep? That kind of thing. So prep is essential. Have a think with the people God's given you of how you can help it. As for long passages, also for long passages, simplicity is really key. So particularly if one of our goals by the end of the year is for people to have some sense of this storyline in their heads, actually, for each individual study, you don't want to pick up too much information. Does that make sense? You want a really clear one idea or maybe two ideas for each study so that you can be building a plot in your head. I think I actually got this wrong a couple of years ago in overview. I think in a desire to be more kind of faithful to the text, closer to the passage, I think I was too nuanced, too many ideas in each study, which meant that it ended up being hard for people to plug the story together because they were trying to carry too much information in their head. So simplicity is key. With that, think main point, clear ideas. I think it's fine to set the agenda for a study. So maybe, possibly at slob level, maybe we go on a voyage of discovery where the leader doesn't really tell us what we're looking at until the group has decided for themselves this is the point of the study. I think for overview group levels, it's fine to set the agenda and say, so for example, in Exodus, this week we're looking at knowing God. Now, what about God does this passage tell us? Or, you don't necessarily have to say what we're learning. It could just be we've now moved to a bit of the Bible that focuses on God relating to people, and we're going to think, how does that work? Or Genesis is a book that lays foundations for the universe, so we're going to look at the kind of basic building blocks in the universe. Does that make sense? It's fine to have a kind of clear lead into the study. Visual aids and teaching aids are really helpful. Again, to simplify, one of the good things about a visual aid is you can't put that much information on it. If it's a good visual aid, you shouldn't be able to put that much information on it. So it forces you to think, what's the thing I want most clear? I want people to remember because we spent time as a group constructing it and it was there on the table, obviously. They also can keep things fun in the densities of Old Testament history. So as we go down as we work our way down some of this stuff, which is very unfamiliar history, thinking to ourselves, how can I convey that history in a way that's engaging? So we've at points had army men, little plastic army men on a map. Others have reused the jelly baby thing from Romans. I'm considering this year, there's a bit, a prophet at one point cuts up a bit of clothing to demonstrate that 10 tribes are going one way and 2 are going the other way. So I'm wondering about cutting up a tie. I think that would really engage people. Get one of my old ties, cut it up and say, look, the bulk of the tie is going over there, Assyria into exile, the rest of the tie is staying, Judah. But just think, kind of how can I get the simple point really clearly, visually explained? And summary is crucial. Summary is crucial. Because again, summary is the chance to say, have we noticed what the big thing is? Do you understand what the kind of overall point is? And that should help, all that should help with both long passages, which you've said, but also the lots of quirky details, don't get too bogged down, don't get lost stuff. So I imagine it will be the case that sometimes someone brings up something they've always wanted to know about. It might be the Nephilim, it might be something else. But by focusing on main points and summarising and having a visual aid that drives the agenda, that can help, even if you waste 5-10 minutes talking about something that there's no answer to or it's quite hard to pin down, you can come back to, but what's the big point? Good, that's long passages. Strange passages. So we said this, that it's unfamiliar territory, lots of the Old Testament. But it's not just it's unfamiliar in that we haven't read it much. It's unfamiliar because it is. There are lots of different genres. And some of them are really strange. Some of them are things that aren't stuff we tend to read nowadays. And I think, ideally, thinking how can we work with the strengths of this genre? So Leviticus, the prep manual says it's a bit like stage directions. It's kind of instructions of how to actually do things, what the priest should wear, what they should do. So acting it out, whether it's a diagram or nominating people in the group to do certain roles, can be really helpful so you see what's actually happening. Imagery, so some of the poetry, Isaiah, actually getting people to visualise. So the lion lies down with the lamb, or the nursing child puts their hand into the cobra's nest. Getting people to just stop and think, hang on, what's that saying? A nursing child, so Matilda, puts her hand into the snake pit in London Zoo. Getting people to actually imagine what's going on so that they feel the force of, wow, creation has really changed. If you can do that and not get into real trouble with Andy Clues, then creation has really changed. There you go. That's permission to do whatever you want in the name of learning. Good. So genres vary. I've put narrative needs care, which is really naff. I'm sorry, that's not a good subpoint. Better would be to say, it needs care in that don't read too much into individual details. Careful not to misuse bits of the story. But also with narrative, we're trying to follow the shape of the story. So we're going to do an example from Genesis, the flood account. We'll actually do as an example in a moment. And you want to see how is the story told. So where are the turning points? What's the flow of the story? Does it end up in a similar place to where it started, or is it moved on? Are there any echoes or repeats, or where is time spent as you go through? Where is the time spent? So with narrative, think kind of how is the story being told? Where is the time spent? Good, that's narrative. Don't get distracted. We've said that. Practically, I think it. I know someone was joking that you can have a questions for answer. You can have the kind of we'll ask that question afterwards, and then you never do. I would still have a piece of paper to write down people's questions that you think aren't going to help you get to the main thing. I don't think we need to be embarrassed about that. I know it's a bit of a cliche in RML, but we are trying to say God sets the main agenda. So even sometimes I might ask someone, they ask a question, I might ask someone, how big a question do you think that is? So someone says, oh, that's interesting that Moses' father-in-law is there. I might say, how big a... And they might have a question about that. How big a thing do you think that is? Do you think that's something we should spend time discussing now, or should we discuss it later? And then later you can say to them, do you still want to discuss it? And often it's actually, no, it's not that relevant. But do come back to it if it is something that someone genuinely cares about. So questions for answers sheet. And with that, teach the principle that God sets the main agenda. Good. That's strange passages. And then finally, on the kind of biggest differences that... I'm aware of selective passages, which is this thing of context. So we are used from Mark and Romans to thinking about book context. So how does Romans 11 fit with everything that's come before and everything that's coming afterwards? How does it work in the book? In the overview, we are not focusing on book context. I will have tried and with some of the other slob leaders, I will have tried to check what the rest of the book is doing in each of the books we look at, and are we cutting really against it? I will have tried to think about that, but realistically, you guys won't have time to think about that, and the group members certainly won't have time to read the whole of whatever it is, the whole of Leviticus, just as we study Leviticus 16, the Day of Atonement. So what we're working on as a group is Bible context rather than book context. We're asking, what does this passage contribute to the Bible story, not to the book it's in, Exodus or Genesis? Now, that sounds probably heretical to RML ears. I don't know if you're thinking, hang on, I've signed up to a cult. They've let Rog lead overview and it's all going wrong. We're forgetting all the good things we learned in RML. I think we want to say book context is really important. So any passage is part of a book and it's part of the purpose of the book. It fits with the purpose of the book. But God has given us two contexts. One is book, Romans, Mark. The other is the whole Bible, his whole book, the whole canon of Scripture, the 66 books, the story, the big story. Now, any responsible Bible reading thinks about both of those, actually. So thinks this passage is part of Mark and fits with what Mark was trying to do with his book. But actually it is also part of the whole Bible, everything God said. And we do that instinctively. We know that Mark or Romans doesn't say everything there is to know about Jesus or about God. It doesn't apply the gospel to every area of life. We know that it's not like as long as you're doing the things mentioned in 12 to 16, you're kind of living a complete Christian life. Actually, we know that God has said more than just a particular book. But we're probably not, we just haven't worked on the skill of how is this fitting in the whole flow of the Bible. And that's deliberate. So RML starts with book context, because that's really important. It's so easy to misuse a passage if you don't think, what's it doing in the book? But actually, having done book context, we do want to say, and there's a whole Bible story. You've got to ask what the passage does in the book, and then what's that whole book contributing to the Bible story? So that's the thing we'll be thinking about. What's this passage doing in the whole flow of God's revelation, the story of God? So actually, I'm in my slog group. I haven't told you guys yet this, but I'm telling you now. We're going to ask for what's the main point, or get you to prep. What's the main point of the passage, and what does it add to the story so far? What's the main point, and what does it add to the story so far? Whereas if we were in Romans, we'd be saying, what's the main point, and how does it contribute to the purpose of Romans? Does that make sense? What's the main point? What does it add to the Bible story so far? Good. And that's because our big hope for this year's Bible studies is that people are going to be putting the story together in their heads, that we're going to be giving people a framework. And it won't, as I said right at the start, it's not necessarily going to be a perfectly accurate framework. We hope it's good, but it's not the definitive, this is the Bible story. But it's a rough stab at the Bible story that from now on people can refine and work with. And it's better than having no sense of the Bible's narrative, no sense of the plot. So in terms of helping people with the study, we want to say things like, yeah, what does this add to the story so far? Is it a surprise? Why? What questions are we left asking at the end of the study? What's unresolved? What might we expect to happen next if we didn't know the story? That's key to reading forwards, as Michael was saying, good to read forwards. And that issue of, if you didn't know where it went, what would you be expecting? What would you be hoping? What would you be fearing at this point is a really good question. And then the big one, what is God teaching us as his plan unfolds? Which is actually now the last session we talked about. Good. That, I think, is the theory. So I've said, overview is similar to normal Bible study leading in lots of ways. Sports cliches are great. So all the usual things, people dynamics, range of questions, that kind of stuff. But it's different because there are long passages, so stay simple, stay focused on the big things. They're strange passages, which means we will need some imagination and nick ideas from each other, nick ideas from Slob on how to teach different bits of the Bible, different genres. And also it's selected passages, which is a challenge. Ideally, we'd read every book of the Bible in its entirety each week, but that would be a bit too much prep, probably. So selected passages, but be thinking, what's this passage doing in the Bible story? What does it add to the Bible story? Any questions? Dan?
So are we saying that because it does sound heretical.
Yeah.
Are we saying that the context of the Bible trumps the context of the book just because of the passages that you selected?
Not quite. I think I'd say both are really important. They're both equally important, I think I'd say, because they're both God-given. But this year we're working more on Bible, just like last year we worked more on book and less on Bible. So actually, last year you probably didn't think much about where you were in the Bible story, but that still is a really important question. It's only because we're in the same place as the Roman Church that you could be quite slapdash about application. You probably very rarely thought, how are we different to the Roman congregation? Because in practice we're not, because we're in the same bit of the Bible story. We're in the same point of salvation history, somewhere over here. So they're always important. Both questions are always important, book context, Bible context. The last 2 years you've worked really hard on book context at the expense of Bible context, but it was okay because they were New Testament books. This year we're working really hard on Bible context, to some degree at the expense of book context, although I'm trying to do some of that. But it's because it's such an important skill to get the Bible context that we need some... part of the way RML's been designed is before people... the mass exodus that happens from St. Helens, before the turnover happens again and everyone goes off to different churches, we want them to have some sense of the Bible story so that they can locate themselves. Because actually, if you get into all sorts of trouble, imagine you're doing RML Leviticus and you work through each week thinking, what's this passage got to do with the book as a whole? And each week you may be seeing, wow, our priests are really important. We need to make sure we invest in our priests. We need to make sure we provide animals for them. We need to take the Day of Atonement. We need a one-year ceremony each year where we deal with our sin by sacrificing a bull. And we need to anoint a high priest. Do you see what I mean? If you're just doing book context, actually, when it's a book that's very distant from us in the Bible story, you're in real trouble if you don't think, hang on, I need to work out in the story what is all that stuff doing. And Hebrews would say, it's all still true, but it now applies to Jesus in a much bigger way. So both are important. Good question, Mitch.
Yesterday we started with creation and then the new creation, and we sort of knew that we were working on a trajectory.
Yeah.
But we're not doing that with our groups. And is that just because we don't want people to keep reading Jesus into the passage?
Yeah, that's been a change, actually. So it used to be, Michael, in the first study, the first study was Ephesians 1, God has one plan. Then the second study was Genesis 1 to 3 with Revelation 21, saying that God's plan has a beginning and an end. And then from then on, it would be, how do we get from A to B? So a lot like Michael did it. We've shifted to we'll have our first study right at the start and we'll let the plan develop as we go. There are pros and cons to that, which I probably won't go into right now. There are pros and cons. I think it's really helpful for us to know where the story is going. Michael, do you want to say anything to that?
Not particularly to that. I just want to say something just related to that, which is to pick up the last point on Roger's sheet about the need to put the Bible story together in people's heads. Because I think that's the thing that we find really hard to do. Some of you will know that over the last couple of years, one of my ministries has been sitting in on some slob groups trying to give leaders feedback, slob leaders feedback. And that's really given me a sense of where a lot of RML is at. And I think a lot of people are very good at looking at the passage and very bad at fitting it in the overall story. And that's not good when you're doing Mark or Romans, and it's a disaster when you're doing the whole Bible, because it loses the whole point of what you're trying to do. So if you've had 30 studies that you've really understood each one, but they're all separate in your head, you really miss the whole point of the year. So it's something to just think about and think, how will I work very hard to make sure my group really get this developing story, putting the story together in your head, our heads? Mm. And I think that's possibly maybe the biggest challenge of the year. Mm.
Which is why it's worth sacrificing some of the detail and nuance, because that's our big agenda for the year. How can we see the whole story unfold? Rather than how can we do a brilliantly sensitive reading of any particular passage. And in terms of why it is that as a whole, as a church family, we're better at observing what a passage is saying than we are at fitting it in, that's partly just what we teach people at different stages. So the RML tools, repetition tool, tone and feel, structure, linking words, they're all observation tools, pretty much. As in what's actually there on the page in front of you. And that's really important, because in our culture, lots of people don't read carefully. Lots of people just skim read and don't notice what's really there. So it's good that we teach people observation tools. But actually, thinking tools, the kind of synthesizing tools of, we got the author's purpose, that's one, but also the kind of what's it doing in the whole Bible story, that people just haven't had much practice at. They haven't been taught to do that. And again, culturally, nobody bothers doing that because nobody thinks there's a meta narrative. So why would you bother to think, how does this detail of life fit with kind of the God who is there or the course of history? Most people don't bother because they just think, oh, it's just another thing that happened. It's just that stuff happens. There's no rhyme nor reason. Don't think about it too much. And as Christians, we want to say, no, stuff doesn't just happen. God has been revealing himself over hundreds of years. So we want to say, not just, read this carefully, observe this carefully, but then synthesize it into the whole story. Jeremy?
Rog, much more of a practical question. You made some very helpful remarks about encouraging prep. Now, I'm sure all of us have had, in our groups in the past, repeat offenders. We can't get a prep, and prep becomes what I can only call the prep war with them. Yeah. From my experience, it's like, so, Uncle Jeremy is banging on about doing the prep again, like the senile old fool that he is. Would you have any suggestions for dealing with these lovely people who are loved by the Lord Jesus?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, probably the language of offender and war. That's right. Wouldn't be my first. Yeah. That's a really good question, and I think there is no one size fits all. That thing I said about one-to-one conversations, I think, is where the real, for people who, there seems to be some sticking point with prep. It really does vary what it is. What it is for them. So one-to-one conversations, I think, are really important. I mean, in practice, some people just won't prep, or will remain inconsistent, and that's a real loss to them. But as I think you were implying, just bullying them harder will probably be counterproductive. As I was saying, with lots of life application in Christian ministry, just bullying people into right behaviour might change them for a couple of months just to keep you happy, but it will build up a resentment that means as soon as they're out of your group or out of RML, they'll think, phew, I never have to touch the Bible again. Whereas encouragement, one of the things I think you can do is hugely encourage any step of progress. So, I ask Rob about this, because his group last year, there was some prep battles going on. So ask him for tips on how he did it. But one of the things we talked about was where someone has definitely put some time in, make a kind of champion of them. Say, both personally to them, say, I really appreciated you prepping hard this week. I know that you may have felt like it was wasted because some of the rest of the group weren't prepped, but it really helped me. It really helped the study. It makes such a difference when you come prepped. Both say that, but also say to the group, something that, without bigging up that person's head, something that says, we're going to work with where this person's got to because they prepped and that's really helped us and given us a head start. In an implicit, it's quite hard work when the rest of you don't prep. Does that make sense? Yeah.
So we obviously don't want people doing prep just to please other people in the group, but I think sometimes people don't understand the effect it has on the group. So I found it really helpful to say, I know it's like you've been doing prep, but how do you think? What effect do you think that has? And they might say, well, I don't get much out of the study. And I say, yeah, that's true. But have you noticed kind of how it affects other people in the group, how it affects discussion, how it affects how real and honest we can be with each other? And oftentimes they're completely unaware that it has any effect on anybody else other than themselves. Mm-hmm. And that can often be a real, oh, I actually do want to love people in my group. So that can help to... Just that.
That's really helpful. And likewise, just what an impact it has on the leaders. Like, I think we can be honest and say, look, I find leading over you quite hard. It really helps me personally if you guys come prepped. That'll do. Good. Sorry, because of time, I'm going to rush us on. Do ask more questions over lunch. I decided after last year it would be useful. Actually, I've got one. Useful to have a worked example. I then realised on Friday, when I was slightly behind time and desperately trying to write a Bible study, that leading an overview study is quite hard. I was like, right, I'm going to write a model study for them all. And then I started. Are we all okay? There may be some extras, that's fine. When I then tried to write a study, it was a lot harder than I thought. So all that's to say, this is not a perfect study. It was written in a rush. But it's my attempt to suggest some of the practical things you might do to put into play some of the principles we've been talking about. Also caveat up front, I think one of the joys of Bible study leading is that not everyone does it the same way, and that's a really good thing. Partly your personalities are different, the way you think is different. So Jess and I actually lead very different Bible studies. Mine are complete chaos, a bit like my life and general, kind of all over the shop, but eventually hopefully end up somewhere helpful. Jess's are much more kind of ordered and make a lot more sense. For a while, because I'm proud, I thought my studies were the best ones because they were exciting. They kind of went with where people were thinking. They were kind of big open questions and different ideas. We just run with whoever had the first idea. And I thought Jess's were a bit kind of constrained and... pedestrian, sorry my love. But then we talked to people in our group and some of them were like, I love Jess's studies. And I was like, what about my studies? But the fact is, different people think differently and different styles of leading are helpful for different people. So this is somewhere hopefully between me and Jess, but don't feel you have to copy my style of leading or my way of laying out the page or anything like that. It's good that we have different styles and it will help different people in your group. And actually, because we're teaching different people, you've got to think, for my group, what's going to be helpful. But all that caveat, this is some of the things you might want to do. First off, in terms of how I lay it out, down the left-hand column, I have kind of a reminder of the big thing I'm trying to do with each question. That's what that left column is. Down the right-hand column, I have time. To be honest, I never stick to these. But at least if you write down what time you're hoping to be at various things, you have a sense. It does two things for you. Three things. Your co-leader knows where you're supposed to be. So they know, can we take more time to discuss this? Or shall I be quiet and help move us on? But also, as you're planning the study, it can help you realise I've got way too much here than I can actually squeeze in. That's often my experience. I start writing how long do I think each question will take, and then by the bottom I'm down at kind of 10:45 in the evening, and I'm thinking, well, that's going to be too long. So then you have to start chopping stuff out so you can realistically suggest how long you're going to take. Good. So that's time. They're the columns. Right. From the top. So you'll see right at the top I've got my main point. Humanity is universally sinful, deserving obliteration. That's the biggest thing I want us to see. And then in brackets, there is another thing there, which I'm happy if people come up with, but it's not the biggest thing I'm trying to see, which is God graciously maintains life. So humanity is universally sinful, deserving obliteration. And I've gone response, interesting, yeah, which is what I'm kind of hoping people will take away. Or how I hope they'll respond, which in this case is a worldview change, see the seriousness of the fall. So what's this adding to the Bible story? We're saying the fall that Adam and Eve had, their sin has spread to humanity, and it's really, really serious. It's not easily dealt with. And so all mankind is evil and deserves obliteration. So it is a worldview shift I'm going for. And the ongoing... also at the top, that begin to realise any hope must come from God's radical grace. That's where I think the next study is going, but we've just got a hint towards it at this stage, in that the only reason the story carries on is God's grace, but Abraham is where it will really go big. Hope that makes some sense. Ask me afterwards if not. So that's my main point. Humanity is universally sinful, deserving obliteration, and my worldview change is to see that sin is serious and universal. Now, someone asked at one point, how in studies do we kind of, I can't remember exactly what the question was, but it's about kind of how do we get some of the application stuff we've been talking about into our actual studies in a way that engages on the worldview level. One thing I sometimes try is to take the worldview change I'm looking for and introduce it right at the start of the study, but often introduce it in terms of what does the world around us say about topic X. Because I'm working on the basis, as Christians, we're far more influenced by the world around us than we think. We have far more vestiges of non-Christian thinking in our hearts than we like to admit. So by starting up front and saying, what do people generally think about topic X, or what do they think about this or that, that gets on the table the kind of worldview change that the kind of worldview that we're going to challenge as we go through the passage. That's what I'm doing with those two questions at the top. What do people think about human nature? And those questions can sound a bit cheesy, like everyone goes, oh yeah, non-Christians think humans are good, and we know the Bible's about to tell us humans are bad, and that's all really obvious. But I think I'd want to push it a bit further and say, do people in your office or your friends really think they're good? Like, do they really think they're good? At which point, actually, people would say, well, no, real non-Christians that I talk to probably think, I let myself down. I know I'm not perfect, but I think deep down I must be good. It's just that bad influences get the better of me, or I make mistakes, or do you know what I mean? So you want to push to what real people think, so that it's a real answer rather than a kind of Sunday school cliche. And then what solutions do people suggest for dealing with our moral problems? I may or may not ask that. Depends how far we got with the first question. So that's flagging up the worldview. It's fairly obvious, but the right-hand stuff is trying to tell you what I'm doing and why. Good. So flag up the worldview. Then a recap. Remember, Michael said we're trying to help people put the story together. So thinking where's the story been is helpful. You can choose when you do it. Sometimes it's better to do that at the end, fitting the passage in. Here I've decided to do it at the start, because I think we haven't had that much of the story, and people should be able to remember the world was created, humanity fell. I'm going to fill in that bit since then, two murders. That's me just giving a précis of what we've jumped. So there have been two murders since then. Things aren't looking good. Then we've got the text work is the next kind of five or six lines in the table. My text work is trying to be really focused. So especially if people haven't prepped much, their eyes can be swimming over a few pages worth of the Bible. And one way to help people is to say, let's all look at verses, in this case, verses 5 to 8, where God gives a kind of summary of what he thinks of humanity, that they're only evil. The intention of his heart is only evil all the time. So we'll all look at that together. One big question. My pattern is the bold question is the big one I'm going to ask. The non-bold questions under them are follow-ups that I might ask if to keep the discussion going and to push people further. So what does God think of humanity? And that is the only question I'm asking about, really. That's the only thing I'm trying to get to of that passage before the flood, that is. Then we'll look at the flood. What does God do about humanity? And here I've slipped in, it's slightly cheeky. Is this a bit harsh? Does he have the right? That is actually a worldview application question. It's a bit cheeky because we're doing the text work. But I want to make sure people are not just playing with the text, reading the words. They are actually starting to connect this with, is that really what God's like? Am I prepared to accept that that's God? What's God like? So that's just a how do you emotionally respond to that kind of question? But also it's a good chance, you'll see on the right-hand side, it's a good chance to bring back in the story so far. So given what we've seen in Genesis 1, of course God has the right to blot out his creation. It's his creation. He made it. He's the one who brought it out of water, the chaos of the watery nothingness. He gave it form so he can take the form away. Does that make sense? So it's a chance to bring the story back in, put the story to work. That's the flood. Then after the flood, now these next three, the after and the storyline thing, these are questions trying to follow narrative flow. So we've set up something before the flood, which is humans are basically bad, although Noah seems to be an exception, and I thought that might come out in my before question. The question is, as the story goes on, what's changed or what's different? So these questions are all trying to kind of follow the flow of the story. And people will notice different things. Some people will be saying, yeah, there's real hope. So Noah is blessed, Noah is told to be fruitful, multiply. But others will notice actually there are some real problems still. Murder is still being planned for. There's still curse on Canaan. Noah gets drunk. There's still nakedness and shame. And crucially, God himself still says the inclination of man's heart is evil all the time. So that would be a kind of, where's the story gone? Has it gone up or has it gone down? And I'd probably use the storyline diagram for that. So we discuss those two questions, and then as a way of summarising and to check and to do this thing, playing squash, getting the whole group to say something, I'd probably say, okay, so story so far, and it's good to keep redrawing this diagram to help people build it bit by bit. So God is there, creation's there. We've had fall. We did flood, and we're on our way back up in Genesis 9. And then I'd say, okay, place your bets. Are we here, so no worse than we were? Here, worse than we were before? Here, slightly better than we were before? Or here, back in Genesis 2, where things were really good? Does that make sense? And I'd probably try and get everyone in the group to have a go and stick their decision. And then we'd thrash that out a bit. And eventually we'd realise, actually, although we have some of the blessings and some of the kind of be fruitful, multiply stuff, in practice, not much has changed because humanity is still just as they were. Does that make sense? So that would say kind of what's just happened in the story. That's all kind of handling the narrative.
Quick question. When I've been around now in the Gospel of the Romans, you often do a recap at the beginning of kind of what we see last week.
Yeah.
Do you feel in OP it works better to kind of kick off with today and then weave in like you've done, kind of, and where does this work given where we're at?
Yeah. I think that really varies, and I think it would vary in Romans as well, actually. It should vary. recaps are... Doing recaps at the start are great if people are capable of recapping at the start. If they can remember what happened last week, it's brilliant. They say stuff, and then you study stuff in light of what you saw last week. If people have come from work and they've prepped today's passage, not last week's, they might well have forgotten what last week was about. And actually, so to give them the very first question, the first challenge of, okay, remember 7 days ago what you were talking about, can be a bit dispiriting. And so it probably depends how memorable the last week's passage was, whether I think they've got a chance of remembering it off straight off or not. The other advantage of delaying the recap is often it's when you've got what this passage is saying, that's when you want to connect it to what the last passage said. Does that make sense? So we think logically, okay, recap last week, and then we'll build on that foundation this week. The problem is it takes you quite a long time to work out what this week's passage is. By that point, you've forgotten your recap right at the start of the study. So sometimes it's better to say, okay, what's this week saying? Humanity's still sinful. What's that adding to what we saw? Last week we saw the fall. What is this adding? Well, the fall wasn't just Adam and Eve's problem. It's everyone's problem, something like that. So up to you. There's no hard and fast rule, but those are some of the kind of strengths and weaknesses of recapping early or recapping late. And it will vary study by study. So there's one in Exodus. The first study in Exodus says God is going to show what he's like. He's going to show what he's like as he rescues. So this, which sets up the next study, which is God, the plagues, where God does rescue. There, I would definitely, right at the start, say, what did we see last week? How did it? What are we expecting this week, given what last week said? Does that make sense? If God said last week, I'm going to show you what I'm like as I rescue you, and this week we're watching the rescue, then we know what we're supposed to be looking for, see what God's like. So it will depend on passage and group. Thank you, good question. So we've handled the text, and you'll notice that is actually quite brief, or I'm not asking that much about the text. There was a before question, what does God think of humanity? A during question, what does God do to humanity? And then a bit of, have things gone up or down afterwards? It's relatively simple, the actual text stuff. So we've done where we are in the storyline. Then I'd want to summarise what's the big point of this passage. So what's the main point God is teaching? I'm moving towards almost always doing that later in the study rather than right up front. You may have been in slob groups where the first thing you're asked is, what's the main point? I think rarely with groups is that the best first question. I think it's quite an intimidating question. I think better to together get some stuff out the text and then together say, so what's the main point? Rather than straight off the bat, stick your colours to the mast, give you the main point. So... but you may have a super sharp group, in which case they may enjoy doing that. So what's the big point the flood is making? And this is something Michael taught me a few years ago. Summary deserves a lot more time than we give it in Bible studies. Summary is, in some ways, the most fruitful time for seeing if people have really got it, seeing if people have understood what it means, what's being said. So... give more time than we'd expect to summary. It's a scary moment, isn't it? It's so tempting just to summarise for the group. Okay, what we should have learned is... and read out your beautiful purpose statement. Problem is, they probably won't remember that after 9:30. Whereas the scary thing of going, okay, let me try it. What do you think this... You guys, what do you think this passage is saying? There may be a rocky moment where someone comes up with something that's really quite wrong, and you think, oh, that wasn't what we were talking about at all. But that's brilliant, because at least that's been revealed, so that other people in the group can say, well, no, hang on, the point isn't that humans are really great after the flood, it's that humans are still quite bad after the flood. And at that point, their thinking is actually changing. So really good, if you can, to get the group to summarise. That is scary, and it takes time. It's risky, and it takes time. But if you can do that, it's really fruitful. It's worth saying, if I was short on time, or if it was complete chaos, I would just summarise for them. I'd just say... okay, this what I hoped we were going to get to was this, to give us time to then do some of the other stuff. So summary, and then I'd probably go back to the Bible story, say, okay, if that's the point, kind of why do we need that in the Bible story? Have we moved up forwards? I think here, is there any hope is quite a good question, because... in one sense, there's no hope. Michael pointed this out last time. In one sense, there's no hope, because humanity are just as bad as they were. and we've just done an experiment that took the best family on the planet, got rid of everyone else, and restarted. I mean, it's the ultimate fresh start with the best people. And so in that sense, we're seeing already that with humanity, there's no hope. But there's a tiny shred of hope, which is the story hasn't ended. So God's covenant with Noah, we said this yesterday, it's not a suggestion that things will get better, but it is a promise that things will carry on. And that's interesting, isn't it? It just suggests, if you're reading the story forward, it suggests God has something more to do with humanity, even though they don't deserve it. He's got something else planned. So I want people to notice that just as we go through. There's no hope with us, that's the big point, but there's a shred of hope with God, which will then be enlarged next week's study, as it were, in Genesis 12 with Abraham's promises. Good. So that's plugging it into the Bible story. And then response. These are the general questions are okay, but I would like much better follow-up questions. I'm afraid I ran out of time on here. But my two areas of application, one is God's character, which I tend to do most weeks. God's unchanging character. What do we see of God? And actually in the prep manual, I've lost mine. In Jesse's prep manual, and yours, hopefully, there'll be questions about the text to help them think about it. Then there's these two boxes. One, how does it apply to God, or our view of God? How does it challenge our view of God? And another one, kind of what's it adding to the Bible story? I'd always ask the God one. The Bible story one will challenge our worldviews in different ways. So it might be, how does it change our view of humanity? How does it change our view of sin? How does it change our view of God? And of the world we live in, of what life's about. So how that applies might be different, but it's the kind of what does it add to the story question. In this example, because I think what the flood is adding to the story is showing the universal nature of sin, that it's spread to everyone, even the best family, and it's so deep you can't get rid of it. My response question, my second kind of area of response would be, what's the picture of humanity here? And that's where we would be challenging where we started. Actually, humans, it's not that we're deep, deep down good, but on the surface mixed. Actually, it's deep, deep down bad, on the surface mixed. Does that make sense? So non-Christians do good things, but God says everything about them on the inside is wicked. And we think, well, that's a bit harsh, but actually that's the way God sees it, because a world that's in rebellion against him, that's not treating him as God, everything you do is wicked. Even if you're being kind to your granny, you're being wickedly kind to your granny, etc. Does that make sense? That's the worldview change. So that's where we'd land. Those questions aren't very good at getting that. I'd change them. And finally, what questions are we left asking? Just to ongoingly say the story's not finished. There's more to come. Good. We should have a coffee break very soon. Any questions people are burning to ask on that? Yeah.
How do we square that Noah is righteous, but no one is righteous, not even one?
Yes, that is hard.
I'm sure someone's going to ask that, having just done Romans.
Yeah. That is hard. I'll go for a couple of things, then Michael might want to help me out. One way of doing it is saying it's credited righteousness, so he's an example of faith, and therefore he has righteousness. And that fits with Noah found favour in the eyes of the Lord, is literally Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. So it might be that. I've toyed with, I'm not sure if this is right, that the narrative is trying to say he is the best. He is, at this stage, he really is a blameless example. Not that he's sinlessly, perfectly righteous in when compared with God's holiness, but the more that the narrative is just trying to say this guy is the best. He's, if you looked at his life, it would be spotless at this stage, so that the shock is stronger after the flood to say even he got drunk and was naked in front of his family, which is shameful. Even he and his family are still described as evil inclination of the heart. Does that make sense? So I think I prefer, though it's tentative, that second. Actually, the reason the story mentions his blamelessness is to set up the shock of, wow, he's not as blameless as we thought he was. But it's also true. Is Noah in the He is in the faith list in Hebrews, isn't it? So it's also true, kind of theologically, that he is a man of faith and so has credited righteousness. But I think that's quite an alien thing from Genesis 6. Genesis 6 isn't yet trying to explain how you get righteous by faith. Genesis 15 with Abraham was credited. That's explicit. So that's where Genesis teaches you become truly righteous by faith. What Genesis 6 is trying to teach is you may think this guy was righteous, but in practice he wasn't. Any other questions? That is an illustration, by the way, of how we will need to kind of shift our reading style a bit from Romans. Romans is kind of really nitty. How does this work theologically? Overview is often, I'm telling you a story, I'll give you some details, but sometimes that's to set up things that go wrong. So Solomon, wisest man on the planet, but then turns out to be quite foolish in what he does. Does that make sense? So when you're told things, it's not always because that's a universal principle. Sometimes it's, this is something to set up the story later. Good. So we should stop. Coffee break. Let's come back at 23 parts. Sorry, Mitch, one more thing to say before I do. 23 parts. Just to summarise that bit. So the study is basically introduce the worldview issue, then fairly simple text work. Summary, how does it fit in the Bible story, and then come back to the worldview. On the simplest level, that's what I'm trying to do. Worldview, simple text work, summary, storyline, worldview. Now, you can rearrange which order you do those components, but I think those are some good components to have in an overview study. Good. Why don't I pray, and then we can coffee. Father, we're so conscious. Your word is precious and powerful. It's like a fire and a hammer and precious gold. And we are not worthy to handle it. And even our best efforts at writing studies and thinking how to lead are never going to do justice to the richness of your word. But we thank you so much that you use us in our weakness, that whether we've been leading for years and years or whether it's our first time ever, we thank you that our frailty and our limited knowledge and our limited skills are no obstacle to the power of your spirit changing people through us. And so we pray for anyone here who's feeling absolutely daunted after that session, thinking, oh man, there's more to this than I thought. Please encourage them. Please help them to trust in you, not them. And we pray for anyone else thinking that they've kind of got RML leading cracked. Please help us to remember that, again, it's not about us, it's about you. And you are the one who changes people. We pray that in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
So back in here just after 20 past. Hey.